came a familiar voice in the background. "Do witches float?" asked Yongi. "I believe they do," said Armand. "Shame."
"I see he's staying where it's safe and warm," said Ruth. "I'd expect nothing less or more."
"Beach," muttered Yongi.
"Bastard," said Ruth. "Oh, and tell him to give my love to my godson. And tell Honoré I have a few more words for him to learn and a special hand signal."
When Ruth moved on, Armand told Yongi their plans for the Bella Bella. There was a pause. "That's still 2 hours away at best. Will the sandbags hold?" "Hard to tell." Armand exhaled, and Yongi could hear the strain. "Annie and Honoré are safe here, and I'm just sitting at HQ with my thumb up my..."
"Got it."
"I'm coming down to help," he glanced at the clock. "If I can get off-island before they close the bridges. See you soon."
But
the line was dead. "Jean-Guy's coming down to help," he reported to the others.
"Dumbass," said Ruth.
But Armand could see relief in the ancient face, illuminated by the flames from the log fire.
"I'm sorry, sir. You'll have to go back. We've closed the bridge."
Beauvoir flashed his credentials, and the officer stepped aside and waved him through, alerting agents along the span to let this vehicle pass. Just as he made it over, Beauvoir heard a huge explosion. He winced and instinctively ducked, even though he knew what it was. In the rearview mirror, he saw a plume of snow and ice shoot into the air. A few minutes later, some distance down the autoroute, he heard another, more muffled explosion. The ice was packed in tight, the St. Lawrence beginning to flood. If this didn't work... As he drove, he monitored the secure Sûreté channels, while dynamite went off in a ring around the island and across Quebec. At least Annie and Honoré were safe on high ground, and he'd return to them by dawn, even if he had to swim across the St. Lawrence to get there. Chapter 13. It had been decided by Ruth, apparently in consultation with a duck and a bottle of scotch, that sentries would be placed on the bridge to sound the alarm should the Rivière Bella Bella break through the sandbags. Renmarie and Armand chose to take the first shift. At the door, Ruth made sure their heavy raincoats were well fastened.
"You have your whistle, in case something happens?"
"I do," said Renmarie.
"And your boy's big book of flooding?"
"Always," said Armand.
"Then we'll be fine,"
said the old poet.
"Fucked up,"
said Gabri.
"Insecure,"
said Olivier.
"Neurotic,"
said Clara.
"And egotistical. Yeah, yeah," said Ruth. "Now, no necking, you two, and be home by midnight."
"Yes, ma'am."
As the rain and ice pellets hit her face, Renmarie called to Armand.
"Heck of a date."
Inside, a discussion had begun around the fireplace. What to take if an evacuation order was given?
"I'd take Gabri," said Olivier.
"I'd take the espresso machine," said Gabri, "and some croissants."
At the bridge they stood, backs to the wind, shoulders hunched, hoods raised. Renmarie put on her flashlight and pointed it into the Bella Bella.
"It's rising,"
she shouted.
"Oui."
"I'd take my Jean Benoit cookbook,"
said Myrna.
"The photo album, the Lalique vase, that hand-knotted Indian rug." "Hold on," said Gabri. "Do you have a moving van? Can we use some of it? I'd take my grandfather's Victorian sofa." "Oh, no, you don't," said Olivier. "The only good thing about a flood wiping out our entire lives is that it'd take that monstrosity with it."
Armand and Renmarie walked over the stone bridge and back again, over and back, pausing every couple of minutes to switch on the powerful flashlight and check the level of the Rivière Bella Bella. Then continue on, like guards on a lonely frontier, back and forth, back and forth. Armand could barely hear his own thoughts for the sound of the water rushing below and the ice pellets hitting his coat. What he thought about as he walked back and forth, was Vivian, out there somewhere, and Vivian's father, and Annie. He tried to keep their daughter out of it, knowing how dangerous it was to personalize investigations. But perhaps his resistance was lowered by the cold, by the competing stresses, by incipient exhaustion, but he couldn't seem to stop putting himself in Monsieur Godin's place. Suppose Annie were missing, and everyone he turned to for help, while nice, didn't actually help. If he pleaded with them, begged them, and all they did was smile and offer soup. It would be a nightmare. He'd be mad with worry. Pausing again at the top of the bridge, he took Renmarie's hand, suddenly feeling the need for comfort. The water in the beams of light was frothing, foaming, like something rabid. It scudded along the lip of the shoreline, rising faster than they'd expected. The jam, just a little way downriver, out of Three Pines, must be getting worse. And then Armand heard a low hum, almost a moan, from Renmarie. As they watched, the Bella Bella broke up and over her banks. It was now racing along the bottom of the sandbags.
"They'll hold," she said. "There's a long way to go before the river reaches us."
"Oui."
Though they both knew that the problem wasn't necessarily the height of the river, but the force of it. The danger wasn't that the water would cascade over the wall, but that it would knock it down. They'd built it two bags thick, so it shouldn't. But then the Bella Bella should never have gotten this high. A lot of things were happening that shouldn't. Just ask Homer Godin, who was living the great should not be happening. Renmarie lifted her eyes and through the sleet saw the lights of St. Thomas's Church on the hill, where volunteers were making sure the children were sleeping soundly and not afraid. They were setting up more cots and organising food, fresh water, generators and composting toilets, should the worst happen. Then she shifted her gaze to the woods.
"Where is she, Armand?"
"I don't know."
"Is she?"
"I don't know."
"But you suspect? Have you spoken to the husband?"
"This afternoon. He's a piece of work. Sûreté's been called to their home more than once. Alcoholic. Maybe drugs."
"Abusive?"
"Oui."
A build-up of trouble that had broken its banks, thought Renmarie. And the young woman was taken at the flood.
"She's pregnant?"
"Oui."
"How could someone?"
But there was no use finishing the question, and there was no answer. They continued to pace, back and forth, back and forth. Still the question rankled. How could someone...
"Can you make him tell you?"
Renmarie shouted above the torrent.
"Short of putting a gun to his head or beating it out of him, no."
In her silence, he knew what she was feeling, if not thinking. Maybe just this once. Maybe in some cases it was justified. Maybe torture. Maybe beatings. Maybe even murder was justified. Sometimes.
"Situational ethics?" he asked.
"Don't be smug," Renmarie said. "We all have them. Even me. Even you."
She was right, of course. It was the asp at the breast of any decent cop, any military leader, any politician, any mother or father, any human. Maybe. Just this once.
"I'd take Ruth," said Olivier.
"Thank you,"
said the old poet.
"Because she's a witch and would float?" asked Clara.
"Of course," said Olivier. "We could cling to her."
"I'd rather drown," said Gabri.
They turned to Billy.
"I think you'd know what I'd take," he said.
"Your tractor?"
asked Myrna.
"So that's how you're doing it,"
Lisette Cloutier muttered as she stared at the IP address.
"You shit."
Over the 15 years she'd worked in accounting for the Sûreté, Lisette had rarely used foul language, and rarely had she heard it. But in homicide she'd heard, and discovered within herself, a whole new vocabulary. It was, she thought, a form of verbal violence to counter the horrific things they saw every day. Instead of lashing out physically, they lashed out verbally. And yet, she thought as she put more commands into her laptop, she'd rarely heard Chief Inspector Gamache swear. She tried to think if she'd ever heard him. Maybe that's why he was in charge. What was it he'd said to that Cameron? The population had a right to expect that people with a gun and a badge would also have self-control. Maybe he had greater control over himself than most. But what was he controlling? and what would happen if it ever broke free. Bob Cameron sat in his car. The sleet had stopped, the skies were clearing, the temperature dropping. His windshield was frosting over, but he could still see stars, the Milky Way, and that single light in the house, in the bedroom. Was Tracy lying on the bed, on top of that comforter with its bright pink and green flowers that Vivian's mother had left her in her will? Was he drinking himself stupid? Stupider. Was that even a word? Or was he packing, planning to run away? Cameron hoped so. That's what he'd been waiting for, hoping for, expecting.
Come on. Come on, you shit. Get in that truck of yours and just try it.
Cameron had been reassigned from the effort to find Vivian Godin to setting up emergency shelters. Sent home to rest, he'd come here instead. Tracy was a weak man, Cameron knew, the sort who'd try to run.
And then what would I do?
But he knew the answer to that. He'd pull Tracy over, tell him to get out of the vehicle, and he'd do what he should have done weeks ago. He looked at his watch. It was almost 1 a.m. He should go home. His wife might be wondering. But he couldn't. Not quite yet.
Come on, you dumbass. Come on out. Come to me.
Billy Williams stood on the road out of town. He held a long, gnarled stick, and as Reine-Marie and Armand watched, he drove it into the mud, as he'd done every 20 minutes for the past couple of hours. He was testing to see how far the stick would sink in, but also, it seemed by his cocked head, listening for some sound from the earth, some permission. The sleet had stopped an hour earlier, and the temperature had plummeted, exactly what they needed. Maybe now.
Well?
Asked Reine-Marie, just as Armand noticed a glow on the hill above them. Headlights. That could be only one person. Jean-Guy had arrived. Billy spoke.
Thank the Lord, said Reine-Marie, turning to Armand. Billy says it's frozen.
Chapter 14. They stood on the frozen field, a few kilometres upriver of Three Pines, and watched as Billy's backhoe dug into the banks of the Bella Bella. The strong beam from the light on the front of his cab illuminated the ice and muck and stones as the shovel dug in. Reine-Marie held her phone in her mittened hand. They had, away from the forests and on the clear, crisp night, a fragile signal that came and went, but was at least there for now. Jean-Guy was beside the river, and Armand stood on the running board, guiding the digging of the trench, while Reine-Marie listened for reports back from Three Pines. They'd left Clara and Myrna on the bridge. The river was now up to the second sandbag. Ruth was in Clara's cottage with her landline, reporting back.
"River's still rising,"
Ruth shouted into the phone, partly to be heard over the roar of the river and partly because she always shouted into a phone.
"Did you see that?"
Myrna shouted into Clara's ear. Damn her, thought Clara, who was busy trying to pretend she hadn't seen anything. But Myrna rarely looked away from some awful truth, preferring to know rather than to live in blissful, if dangerous, ignorance. It was one of her worst qualities.
"They've shifted!"
Myrna turned and yelled across to Ruth.
"Tell them to hurry! They've shifted!" "What's that?" "They've shifted!" "Well, you're pretty shitty too."
Gabri, standing beside Ruth in the kitchen, grabbed the phone.
"Here, give me that. Reine-Marie, the sandbags are beginning to shift."
"Merde."
"Hey, hey."
They turned and saw a flashlight approaching.
"Keep digging,"
Armand yelled into Billy's ear, then jumped off the backhoe.
"What are you doing? This is my land,"
came a man's voice. Armand gestured to Reine-Marie to stay where she was and walked toward the light and the shout.
"Sûreté, who are you?"
But he knew the answer to that, because he knew whose land they were on. Jean-Guy left the river and joined Armand. The man was still 20 paces away and held a flashlight in one hand and something else in the other.
"He's got a gun,"
said Jean-Guy, his sharp eyes not leaving the man slipping and stumbling toward them.
Oui, said Armand, and took a step in front of Renmarie. A 22, hunting rifle. Saw it earlier, in the search. He has a permit.
Fuck, muttered Jean-Guy, shaking his head.
A 22, small gauge, but it could still do damage. To a gopher, a fox, a human.
This is private property,
Tracy shouted.
Get off!
They were downwind of him and could smell the whiskey. The donkeys had been put in the barn overnight, so it was just humans now in the field.
Monsieur Tracy, it's Armand Gamache. We met earlier today.
I don't care who you are. You're on my land.
Tracy stopped 10 paces away and raised his rifle.
Get off!
Armand,
said Renmarie, stepping forward.
It's all right, he said,
and put his arm out to gently move her behind him. Obviously, she thought, his idea of all right and hers were very different.
What's happening?
Came Gabri's tinny voice down the phone.
Renmarie?
Drop the gun, commanded Beauvoir.
Gun?
Came the tinny voice.
Hello?
Get off my goddamned land,
yelled Tracy, the rifle still raised. Billy had stopped digging. Armand turned to him and shouted,
Whatever happens, keep digging.
Yes.
The machine began again, and Tracy stepped forward, slipping slightly on the snow and mud. The danger, Gamache could now see, wasn't just that he'd fire the rifle on purpose, but that he'd slip and it would go off accidentally.
I said stop,
yelled Tracy.
And I said drop the gun,
said Beauvoir, stepping directly in front of Armand. Directly in front of the gun.
Oh my God,
shouted Armand and waved toward the river. Renmarie, alarmed, turned, as did Tracy. The only one who didn't was Beauvoir, who was expecting Gamache to do something like this, divert, just for a moment, Tracy's attention. Jean-Guy's hand shot out and wrenched the rifle from his grip. When Tracy lunged for it, Beauvoir pivoted and knocked him to the ground. Gamache bent down and lifted the drunken man to his feet.
We're diverting the river, he explained, to stop the...
You have no right! This is private land,
Tracy shouted. With a yank, he twisted away from Gamache and ran toward the backhoe, waving and shouting,
Arret! Arret! Stop!
But of course, Billy did not. He hadn't seen that Beauvoir had disarmed him. As far as Billy knew, a man with a rifle was running toward him and might very well shoot. But Billy didn't care. Myrna was down there. The bags were shifting, and only he could stop it. He pushed the shovel in deeper and dragged it forward into the field, just as Gamache caught up with Tracy and, grabbing him around the waist, hauled the man around and away. With a gush, the Bella Bella began pouring into the field.
Hello?
Came a tinny voice. There was no deluding herself any longer. The wall was coming down. It was time to leave, Clara knew. Not just the bridge, but her home. The village. Time to abandon Three Pines to fate. Myrna and Clara quickly made their way off the bridge, half walking, half running. The last of the villagers had to get out of Clara's home, out of Three Pines, and up to the church. From there, they would witness the destruction.
Wait, said Clara, grabbing Myrna's arm.
Every particle of Myrna's being was straining forward, telling her to flee, now. But she stopped and waited for a moment, because Clara had. Too afraid even to speak, she stared at the circle from Clara's flashlight. It rested, trembling, on the now askew sandbags. Some had fallen, some were preparing to slide away, pushed by the force of the water. She had to make sure.
Oh, shit,
she heard herself whisper. Armand was physically holding Carl Tracy around the abdomen while the man kicked and squirmed. Jean-Guy hurried over to help contain him, but just as he arrived, Tracy slowly stopped thrashing, and a moment later he was standing still, clasped against Gamache's body. Both men were staring.
Stop!
This time it was Gamache who was shouting at Billy. The floodlight on the top of the backhoe was pointing at the bucket of debris Billy had just dropped onto the field, next to the water rushing out of the Bella Bella.
What's that?
Asked Renmarie, taking a step closer.
Beauvoir saw then why Gamache had stopped the digging, why Tracy had stopped fighting, and why he'd been so hysterical to stop the digging.
"What's that?"
Gabri shouted at Clara and Myrna. He tried to keep the panic out of his voice.
"What are you saying?"
The two women were waving their arms and yelling something about the river. If he had to guess, and it seemed he might have to, whatever they were shouting was not good news. Billy went to dismount his machine, but Armand waved him to stay where he was and told Renmarie the same thing. Then he and Jean-Guy slowly approached the trench.
"Armand, Gabri's saying something. Something's happened."
"What?"
yelled Billy from the cab of the machine.
"What?"
yelled Gabri again, completely forgetting he had Renmarie on the line.
"What?"
came the tinny voice.
"The water level's going down."
Gabri and Renmarie heard it at the same moment, Clara's shout. And then Renmarie heard shouts of joy. Even Ruth was cheering. At least she thought that cackling was a cheer.
"The water level's dropping,"
Renmarie reported.
"It's worked. It's dropping."
Billy gave a whoop. But while both Armand and Jean-Guy looked over, Armand smiling with relief and Jean-Guy nodding, they quickly looked away. In the harsh beam from Billy's backhoe, something pink was lying in the muck. Armand knelt and reached out. It was a bright pink duffel bag with a name tag, a single embossed letter. V. Chapter 15.
"What have you done with her?" Gamache demanded.
"Nothing. I've done nothing. Maybe it isn't hers."
"It's hers," said Gamache. "It's Vivian's, and you know it."
Tracy recognized it, but Gamache also recognized something. The look on Carl Tracy's face. He'd seen it before, when a piece of damning evidence, thought hidden, was found. It was the unmistakable look of dread. While he stayed with Tracy and the duffel bag, Beauvoir went to the river and was walking the banks, shining his flashlight to see if he could see something else, someone else. As he walked, Beauvoir's heart thudded in his chest, in his wrists, at his temples, and in his throat. His skin tingled. His face, in the cold, was flushed. He'd spent much of his adult life looking for bodies, at bodies. What was out there didn't scare him. What frightened him was what was in there, inside himself. What dark thing had been aroused, awoken, when he realized he was in the presence of someone who'd almost certainly thrown his wife and unborn child into a freezing river to die. It was all Jean-Guy Beauvoir could do not to turn around, march back to Tracy, tell Armand and Renmarie and Billy to look away while he forced Tracy to a kneeling position, took out his gun, placed it at the base of the monster's skull, and fired. Jean-Guy paced, pointing the flashlight this way and that, trying to settle his mind and focus on the job at hand. What he saw were shards of ice, rocks, roots uprooted, debris, rushing water, but no Vivian. At Beauvoir's request, Billy had turned his backhoe so that its light faced the river. From the cab, Billy Williams watched Jean-Guy pace. He knew torment when he saw it. Then he looked over at Armand, standing right up against Carl Tracy, not side by side, but facing him in an act of extreme and ghastly intimacy. Billy Williams knew that what he was witnessing was also an act of love, not for Tracy, of course, but for Jean-Guy. Armand had sent the younger man away to, on the surface, do the worst job, to look for the body of a young woman and her unborn child. But in reality, Armand was saving Jean-Guy from himself. Gamache was standing that close to Carl Tracy so that Beauvoir didn't have to. When Tracy backed up, Gamache moved forward, not letting the Weasley man step away. Get away. Gamache was at least 2 inches taller, 20 pounds heavier, and 25 years older than Tracy. He had the advantage of height, weight, control, and sobriety. but Tracy had the greater advantage of knowledge. He knew where Vivian was. Gamache's boots thucked in the mud as he stepped even closer to Tracy.
"Tell us," Gamache repeated, his eyes not leaving Tracy's. "Where's Vivian?"
"I don't know. She went away," said Tracy. "Ran away with some guy she was..."
"Enough," said Gamache. "What did you do with her?"
Then he modulated his tone, corralling with difficulty his anger. His voice, when he spoke again, was unnaturally reasonable, coaxing a brute to do one decent thing.
"Tell us, Carl. Let us give her some rest."
Behind them, the Bella Bella ran off into the mucky field. The night air was crackling with cold and outrage.
"I've no idea where she is. Maybe she got drunk and fell into the river. Or maybe whoever got her pregnant tossed her in."
Out of the corner of his eye, Armand saw Renmarie take a step closer. Her hand gripped the phone as though it were a baseball bat. Somehow this vile man had managed to stir up in Renmarie an outrage that bordered on violence. Gamache's own breath through his nostrils came out in long, warm puffs, like a bull longing to charge. He barely registered that behind him, Billy Williams was speaking.
"There's no sign of her," called Beauvoir. "Billy says he thinks the duffel bag came from farther upriver."
"There's an old logging road about a kilometre from here,"
Billy waved behind him.
"A bridge goes over the Bella Bella. It's been closed for a while now, but hunters sometimes use it in the fall."
Jean-Guy translated what was said. Gamache turned and looked at the .22 leaning against the backhoe, a hunting rifle.
"Can you show us?" he asked.
"Yes."
"What about the bag?" Renmarie asked.
"We'll take it with us," said Gamache.
"You can't,"
said Tracy. "Then we'll open it here," said Beauvoir. Gamache asked Renmarie to use her phone to record the search of Vivian's bag, while Billy took his place beside Tracy.
"No,"
said Tracy.
"Stop. It doesn't belong to you. It's on my property. It belongs to me."
"It belongs to your wife," said Beauvoir, unzipping it. The duffel bag contained all the things you'd expect someone to pack who was going away for a few days. T-shirts, a pair of jeans, some shorts, pyjamas, underwear, toiletries. "What are these?" Gamache held up a bottle of pills and read off the label.
"Mifejimiso."
When the others shook their heads, Gamache held them out for Tracy to see.
"How should I know? Probably some street drug she picked up the..."
"Enough!"
Beauvoir got to his feet and took a step toward Tracy.
"Jean-Guy,"
snapped Gamache. The cold, the exhaustion, the find, the growing certainty of what had happened to this young woman, and who'd made it happen, were all fraying their nerves. Beauvoir glared at Tracy, but managed to contain himself.
"We're done," said Gamache, zipping the duffel bag shut. "We'll take this with us and give you a receipt."
"I don't want a receipt. I want the bag."
"You're coming with us,"
said Beauvoir, and shoved him toward the car as they all trudged across the field, leaving the backhoe to sink further into the mire. When they reached the car, Beauvoir placed the duffel bag in the trunk, and Gamache, having removed the bullets, put the .22 back there, too. Tracy stood beside the car.
"Get in," said Gamache.
When Beauvoir went to get in beside him, Gamache held out the keys.
"Why don't you drive? Can you get in the front seat?" he asked Renmarie,
who'd stopped recording and slipped the phone into her pocket. Gamache and Billy got into the back seat, with Tracy between them.
"She isn't dead, you know. She's messing with you all, trying to get me into trouble. I bet she threw that fucking bag into the river herself. You wait. When she shows up after a bender with some guy, I'll be suing your ass."
"Let's hope," said Gamache.
Beauvoir drove while Billy pointed the way to the old logging road. They came to little more than a break in the trees. Turning in, Beauvoir felt the tires begin to sink.
"We have to walk from here."
The five of them followed the flashlight beams down the narrow lane through the trees. The limbs of the trees loomed overhead, a tunnel of dead branches. Their flashlights created shadows so macabre that even Beauvoir, not given to fantasy, felt his skin crawl. This was how horror films began, or ended. And then it got worse. Beauvoir's stronger beam landed on something up ahead, blocking the way. A car.
Stay here, Gamache said to the others, while he and Jean-Guy approached.
It was Vivian's. Gamache nodded to Beauvoir, who carefully walked around to the other side and shone his light through the rear window, while Gamache looked in the front. Nothing. Opening the driver's door, careful not to touch too much, Gamache played his light over the seat, the wheel, the footwells. There were assorted wrappers, some change. It smelled of stale cigarette smoke. He checked the ashtray and found Stubbs, the same brand Tracy smoked. There was a smear of blood on the steering wheel, and another in the shift. The hair on the back of Gamache's neck was standing on end. Something awful had happened here. He pulled a lever and popped the trunk.
Nothing, Beauvoir reported.
Gamache closed the car door, and both investigators made for the wooden bridge.
Don't worry, shouted Tracy. It's safe. No, it's not, called Billy. It's probably rotten.
Beauvoir reached out and stopped Gamache, who was just about to step on the wooden boards. Armand had heard Billy, but hadn't understood. Beauvoir turned and glared at Tracy, who was smiling.
Worth a try,
Tracy said, his eyes cold, calculating. Renmarie took a step away from this creature, while Beauvoir wondered if all five of them would make it out of the woods. From the safety of solid ground, Gamache and Beauvoir shone their beams along the old logging bridge, then stopped. The two circles of light converged on a single spot. A section of wooden handrail was missing. The side opened up to thin air. Gamache pointed his beam down, into the drop-off. 20 feet below, maybe more, was the churning river, grabbing, dragging, swallowing all that it could. They played their lights over both shores, but there was nothing. Then Beauvoir's beam stopped.
Wait, I think I see something.
Gamache swung his flashlight over to the far shore.
What is it?
Called Renmarie.
Have you found something?
No, it's nothing, said Beauvoir, relieved. Just branches.
They looked like a body for a moment. He moved his flashlight away.
We can't search the bridge or shoreline right now. Too dangerous. It'll have to wait till morning.
But Gamache's light hadn't moved. In the beam, he saw what Beauvoir had seen. Tree branches bobbing slightly in the current. Nothing more. He could see why Beauvoir would mistake. Opening his mouth, Gamache took a sharp breath, almost a gasp.
What is it? Asked Beauvoir. Do you see something?
Once more he swung his light over to join Gamache's until the two became one bright spot. Beauvoir looked more closely at the clump of debris on the opposite bank, but still saw nothing. Certainly not anything that would explain the expression on his father-in-law's face. It was one of surprise, shock even.
Vivian's not here, Gamache said,
then looked at Beauvoir.
But I think I know where she is.
Chapter 16. The two men ran along the path, the river on one side, the forest on the other. Jean-Guy skidded once and went down on one knee in the mud. Armand grabbed his jacket and hauled him to his feet. And then they continued on, their flashlights bobbing wildly ahead of them, illuminating trees, paths, rocks, river. They didn't have far to go, just to the bend in the river. When they'd arrived back in Three Pines, they'd taken Carl Tracy to the bistro, where they found Olivier and Gabri, now that the danger of flooding had passed.
Keep him here, Gamache had instructed them. Billy will stay with you.
Homer? At your place, Olivier said. Clara and Myrna took him there, hoping he'd get some sleep. They're staying with him.
What time is it?
Asked Renmarie.
2:30, said Gabri.
That late?
That early, he said. The wee hours, as Ruth calls it.
Where is she, by the way?
She went home. Had to wee.
Renmarie glanced at Tracy. He was in the far corner where he'd been placed by Jean-Guy, far away from the warmth and soft light of the fireplace. Then she turned to Armand.
I'll make sure Homer doesn't come over here. You go.
And Armand and Jean-Guy did. Even though both men knew there was no need to rush, Still, they ran, down the path, beside the wall of sandbags. They ran behind the general store, the boulangerie, past the back of the bistro and the bookstore, the Bella Bella on one side, Forest on the other. And then they were there. Gamache was panting and holding his flashlight out in front of him with both hands, like a gun, aiming the beam, steadying it as he stood beside Beauvoir. Their lights, pointed in the same direction, merged. And then they saw it. Her. Gamache had been there earlier, when he and Olivier had checked the river levels. They hadn't come quite this far, but still, he'd seen it then as he'd leaned out, Olivier holding on to him. The growing dam. He'd noted the pale tree limbs and leaves bobbing up and down in the current, trapped in the broken ice and debris that was forming. He'd hesitated, trying to get a closer look, but Olivier's grip had been slipping and he was pulled away. Now he was back, and he saw, in the bright circle of light, his mistake. At the logging bridge, Beauvoir had momentarily taken trees for a body, and in that moment, Armand Gamache realized he'd done the same thing, only in reverse. He'd mistaken a body for trees. Now he looked once again at the tangle of ice and tree limbs. Debris and detritus picked up by the Riviere Bella Bella as it rushed down from the mountains. Here was Vivian Godin. This is where she'd come to rest. Her dark hair, like leaves, floated on the surface, moving with the current. Her pale arms and legs, limbs, now so clearly human. Armand Gamache crossed himself, just as Beauvoir shoved his flashlight into Gamache's hands.
"What are you doing?" "What does it look like?" Beauvoir stripped off his coat. "I'm going to get her." "You can't."
Gamache placed himself between Beauvoir and the Bella Bella and reached out.
"Stop!"
But Beauvoir wasn't listening to reason. He looked at the bobbing head, at the arms, and he saw Annie.
"Step aside," he said to Gamache.
"No."
"Step aside. That's an order."
"No."
Jean-Guy then did something he'd not have thought possible 24 hours earlier, an hour earlier, a moment earlier. He shoved his father-in-law, who dropped the flashlights and took a step back, partly from the force of it, partly from the shock of it.
"Get out of my way!"
Jean-Guy yelled, desperate to get to the young woman, as he hoped someone would try to save Annie, if... This time Gamache saw him coming and wrapped his arms around Jean-Guy, gripping him in a bear hug so tight that Jean-Guy could smell the slight scent of sandalwood and feel Armand's heart thudding against his own.
"It's too late,"
Armand said, directly into Jean-Guy's ear. But still he struggled. Finally, the fight went out of him, and he sagged in Gamache's arms.
"She's gone,"
Armand whispered, his own eyes screwed shut.
"She's pregnant,"
sobbed Jean-Guy.
"Yes, I know."
"Annie. Annie's pregnant. Almost 3 months."
Armand's eyes opened, and he heard a sob. One, single, burst of emotion, which might have been Jean-Guy's, or his own, or maybe it came from the Bella Bella as the river cried out. And then he realized where it had come from. Releasing Jean-Guy, he turned and looked up the path. In the darkness, there was a greater darkness. A large figure, a father figure, outlined against the trees, standing silent, rigid. Then Vivian's father started forward, one step at a time, picking up speed until he was running down the path.
"Homer, stop!"
shouted Gamache. But Vivian's father didn't. Couldn't. He made not a sound, but ran straight for the river. Gamache and Beauvoir just had time to step between Homer Godin and the water, but they might as well have been made of paper. Homer ploughed right through them, running straight into the Bella Bella, wading in, breaking through the thin ice at the shore. He fought his way forward to get to his little girl. Gamache and Beauvoir plunged in after him. The water was so cold, their eyes watered, and their breath came in gasps, but on they lurched, toward the man thrashing through the current ahead of them. The water churned and frothed as Godin, his arms flailing wildly, knocked them off. He fought ferociously,
screaming now, wailing, baying, sobbing. Gamache got an elbow in the head and was knocked backward, submerged. So cold was the water that his chest locked, and he couldn't breathe, even when arms pulled him to the surface. It was Jean-Guy. Armand stared at him for a moment, then managed, with a great whoop, to get air back into his lungs. Then it was back to Gaudin, who, after what seemed like hours, finally tired of dragging them with him. Like some great whale harpooned, he slowed, slowed, sobbing, then stopped. It took both of them to drag Vivian's father back to shore. But Homer Gaudin wasn't finished yet. Once again he tried to break free, but this time they were ready for him, and he had little fight left in him.
"Stop," said Beauvoir softly.
And he did.
"Vivian!"
"I'm sorry," Armand said. Homer looked out into the river.
"Please,"
he whispered.
"I need to get her."
"We will,"
said Beauvoir. His teeth were chattering, and he was finding it difficult to form words. He looked over at Gamache, whose lips were purple and trembling in the cold. They were all on the verge of exposure. With Homer Gaudin also suffering from shock, it was a potentially fatal combination.
"Not you,"
said Homer, his voice shaky.
"Me. I have to help her. I can get to her. Let me try."
"The water's too cold. You'll drown," said Gamache through chattering teeth.
"Does it matter?"
"It matters."
But Armand understood. He'd try too. He'd fight too. He'd run back into that freezing water too, if... Homer turned away from him to once again face the river, and his daughter in the middle of it, bobbing gently up and down in the current, her body knocking against the ice. A small sound escaped the large man. Only then did Armand notice a figure standing farther down the path toward the village. Even at a distance, even in the dark, he knew who it was. He walked toward her.
"I'm sorry," said Renmarie. "I tried to stop him, but he ran out of the house so fast. He must have been watching from the bedroom window and seen you come here."
Armand bent his face close to hers.
"Your face? It's bruised."
"Is it?"
"Did he hit you?"
"Not on purpose. He didn't know what he was doing. I reached for his arm to try to stop him."
Armand brought one shaking finger to within a millimetre of the bruise on Renmarie's cheekbone, below her eye. It was swollen and swelling further. Gamache could feel himself begin to tremble uncontrollably. It came in waves, sending shudders through his body. It was, he recognised, the beginning of hypothermia and outrage.
"My God, Armand, you're soaked. You need to get warm."
She looked down the path and only then noticed that Jean-Guy and Homer were also dripping wet. Homer was standing on the shore of the Bella Bella, staring. She followed his eyes.
"Is that..."
"Oui."
Chapter 17. The water cascaded over Armand's body as he showered. Over his head, over his upturned face. He opened his mouth and shut his eyes, and felt his body finally getting warm. But then, unbidden, a sudden panic took him. He was back in the water, submerged, but this time Jean-Guy wasn't there. No one was there to reach down and save him. His eyes flew open, and he dropped his head, away from the water. Reaching out, he leaned against the wet tiles of the shower. As he breathed, he knew his momentary terror was just a tiny part of what Vivian must have gone through. The horror of those final moments, breaking through the railing, hanging in mid-air, nothing between the bridge and the water to stop her fall. And then she fell. Hitting the freezing cold water, the breath knocked out of her, the shock, the bitter Bella Bella closing over her, and then she breached, breaking the surface, mouth open, fighting for air. The struggle to keep head, mouth, nose above the water, to take a breath, turning, tumbling, thrashing in the current, hitting rocks and branches. The terror, the tumult, the desperate struggle, growing less and less desperate as the cold and the battering began to win. And finally, the knowing. Both hands on the tiles, his head hanging down, warm water hitting his back, Armand gasped for breath and watched the water swirl around the drain. "Annie's pregnant. Annie's pregnant," he repeated, following the words to the surface, and trying not to allow the rest of that thought to seep in. But still, it was there. And so was Vivian. He opened his eyes and finished his shower, then went downstairs to face Vivian's father. Homer and Jean-Guy were in the kitchen, in front of the wood stove, wrapped in Hudson's Bay blankets, mugs of strong tea in their hands. Armand kissed Reine-Marie softly on her bruised cheek. "You okay?" he whispered. The bruise wasn't as bad as he feared, more a glancing blow, but a blow nonetheless.
"I am."
Armand looked at her closely to make sure she was telling the truth. Then he turned his attention to the others. Jean-Guy had stopped trembling. Homer had not. As soon as they'd returned to the house, they'd called the Sûreté divers and a scene of crime squad from Homicide. But with the state of emergency across the province, they were told it could take some hours. Not before morning, for sure. After letting Isabelle Lacoste and Agent Cloutier know what had happened and asking them to come down, they'd split up. Jean-Guy had grabbed a shower first, while Armand helped Homer to strip off his wet clothing and get into his own shower. He stayed with the man, who'd sunk into silence, until the shower was over and Homer was in warm, dry clothes. Armand stayed with him in the kitchen until Jean-Guy returned. While he knew it wasn't Homer's fault, and it would almost certainly never happen again, he was damned if he'd leave Reine-Marie alone with Homer. Mad with grief, Vivian's father was capable of almost anything. Certainly, Armand knew, capable of murder, though that was aimed at only one person. After his own shower, Armand returned to the kitchen and caught Jean-Guy's eye. Both men turned to Reine-Marie.
"What?"
she asked. "Jean-Guy has something that might make you feel better," said Armand quietly.
"Can you come with me?"
Jean-Guy stood up. After a brief, baffled glance at Armand, Reine-Marie followed her son-in-law out of the kitchen. Fred had put his large head on Homer's slippered feet, and Henri did the same with Armand. Little Gracie was curled up on a blanket close to the fire. The only sound was the slight rattle of the old windows as the night tried to get in. Not, perhaps, realizing it was already dark in there. A few minutes later, Reine-Marie and Jean-Guy returned. She was flushed, and her eyes were moist, and when she met Armand's, his too began to burn. She brought her hands to her mouth, and he embraced her.
"I just spoke to Annie. A baby," she whispered,
words meant only for Armand. Homer did not need to know that they were living his dream while he lived their nightmare. Excusing himself now, Armand went into his study and, picking up his phone, tapped in a familiar number.
"I'm sorry," he heard the polite young receptionist say, "but Chief Superintendent Toussaint can't take your call right now."
"Tell her it's Armand Gamache."
There was a pause.
"She knows."
Now it was his turn to pause.
"Merci."
Then he called the senior RCMP commissioner who'd been in the meeting the day before.
"Armand, what is it?"
He sounded weary.
"I wanted an update on the flooding."
"Did you call Toussaint?"
"I tried."
Again there was a pause. Gamache could feel the embarrassment down the line.
"It's a hectic time,"
the officer said.
"Oui. Can you tell me what's happening?"
"The dynamiting on the St. Lawrence worked, but it looks like a temporary reprieve. The thaw's moving north."
"The dams?"
"Holding. Barely. The pressure's building. And they still can't decide whether or not to open the floodgates."
"Go on."
Gamache, who knew the man well, could hear the hesitation.
"I've consulted with the Armed Forces Engineer and Hydro-Québec. We're not waiting for approval. Hydro's going to open the gates."
Gamache took a deep breath.
"You know that what you're doing could be considered insubordination."
You think? Well, you're the expert, I guess,
the Mountie said with a laugh. He sounded drained.
Once the floodgates are open, we'll pull the machinery from all but the most vulnerable dams and move it south. The Corps of Engineers will then begin digging trenches along rivers that are threatening communities. More insubordination. I don't think they're going to let us play together any more, Armand. You're a bad influence.
Gamache gave a small sound of amusement. It was all he could muster.
Armand?
Oui?
Be careful of Toussaint.
She's doing well, Gamache said. These are difficult decisions. She'll grow into the job.
But what job? She has political aspirations.
Nothing wrong with that.
Except she's using her position in the Sûreté not as a responsibility, but as a tool, a springboard. Surely that was obvious in the meeting. She needs to distance herself from you, distinguish herself from you.
Your point being?
With this flood, with our decision to follow your suggestion and not waiting for her approval, she'll be gunning for you.
Not literally, I hope. But there was silence down the line, both remembering when that was exactly what senior officers had done to each other, literally, in the time before.
No, but she's no friend of yours. You have the support and loyalty of the rank and file, Armand. She doesn't.
Give her time.
Have you been following the social media posts about you?
A bit.
Where do you think some of that information's coming from?
Are you kidding? Said Gamache. You think Madeleine Toussaint is leaking it? There was silence.
You're wrong, said Gamache. How can you be loyal to her, Armand, when it's so clearly not mutual?
Does it have to be mutual? She's a decent person who stepped up. She's earned my loyalty, and she'll grow into a great leader. I know that. Otherwise, I'd never have suggested her for chief superintendent.
There was no one left, said the Mountie, his exasperation growing. Everyone else was either wounded or tainted by your actions. Even if you hadn't recommended her, Toussaint was the only one standing. Look.
There was a heaved sigh down the line.
I hope I'm wrong. Just be careful. You've got to know, once she gets wind of what we're doing, she'll blame you, even if we're successful.
God willing we are. That's all that matters.
Inshallah.
Bezrat Hashem, said Gamache. We'll worry about the rest later. Good luck. Let me know.
I will, my friend. Anything I can do?
Armand looked toward the kitchen. Do you have any divers you can spare?
Huh?
As the RCMP divers reached the body, Beauvoir heard a sharp intake of breath and prepared to grab hold of Vivian's father, if necessary. But it wasn't. Homer Godin stood on the shore, face rigid, body at attention. Only when the team turned Vivian over did he move, but not forward, as they expected and were prepared for. Vivian's father sank slowly, slowly to his knees. Then, slowly, slowly, he folded over, his head in the muck, his hands clutching the ground. The big man curled himself around his heart. As Vivian Godin approached the shore, her father lifted his head, sensing more than seeing her close by. Then he raised his body, sitting back on his heels, and, with the help of Gamache and Beauvoir, he struggled to his feet. They kept their hands under Homer's arms, supporting him, holding him upright. Homer was swaying, open-mouthed, eyes glazed, as Vivian was lifted onto a stretcher. Dr. Harris bent over the body. Glancing at Gamache and Beauvoir, she shook her head, confirming what was painfully obvious.
I need to see her, said her father.
Dr. Harris whispered to Gamache,
It isn't good. She's been in the water at least 2 days. We need an identification, said Beauvoir.
Lisette Cloutier, who just arrived, said,
I'll do it.
Me,
said Vivian's father.
Me.
I'll take you over, said Armand quietly. But you must promise not to touch her. If we're going to get enough evidence to convict, no one but the investigators must touch Vivian. Do you understand? Homer's heavy head bobbed up and down.
Are you ready? Armour asked.
He nodded again. They escorted Vivian's father to Vivian's body. He stared down at her, with the eyes of a man who'd reached the end of a long tunnel and realized there was no light there. He gave one curt nod and mouthed,
"That's Vivian."
Then, with more effort, he said it out loud.
"That's Vivian."
He brought his hand up to his face, covering his mouth, in a grotesque imitation of Renmarie's joy just hours earlier. Gamache looked down at the body. Her blue eyes were open, not in fear, but in that surprise they often saw in those suddenly prematurely meeting death. He wondered if death had been just as surprised. Gamache swiftly, expertly took in the condition of her body before meeting Beauvoir's eyes and nodding.
"Come away," he spoke softly to Homer. "We'll let the officers do their job."
"No," said Homer. "I need to stay with her until... Please, I won't make trouble. I promise."
He motioned toward a tree stump, and Gamache nodded.
"Of course."
Then turned to Cloutier.
"Stay with him, please."
Gamache noticed then a uniformed agent walking down the path toward them.
"What are you doing here?" Gamache asked. "You're supposed to be guarding Carl Tracy."
"I was relieved."
"By whom?"
"Agent Cameron."
"He's there with Tracy, alone?"
"Well, there are others. The owners of the bistro."
"Come with me."
Through the windows of the bistro, Gamache could see Bob Cameron. He was standing within feet of Carl Tracy, who was crammed into a corner, his chair overturned at his feet. Cameron held something in his right hand, something black.
His gun?
No, Gamache took in quickly as he made for the door. Not a gun. Too big. It was a fireplace poker, as lethal as a gun is swung at a person's head. And it looked, by his stance, that that was exactly what Cameron was preparing to do. Tracy was raising his arms to protect himself. Gamache opened the bistro door with a bang, and Cameron turned around.
"He's going to kill me,"
shouted Tracy.
"Stop him."
"Shut up, you stupid shit."
"Cameron,"
snapped Gamache,
"step away. Now."
After a slight pause, Cameron threw the poker onto the floor in disgust and stepped back.
"I wasn't going to hit him," he said. "I just wanted to scare him."
"Get over there,"
said Gamache, pointing to the far corner. The former left tackle jerked toward Tracy, who squeezed tighter into the corner. Then Cameron marched away, shoving a table as he passed Gamache.
"What's happening?"
asked Gabri, coming cautiously out of the swinging door between the bistro and the kitchen, followed by Olivier, who was holding up a frying pan.
"Nothing,"
said Cameron.
"Nothing?" demanded Tracy. "He was going to hit me with that."
He pointed to the poker. "Did you see anything?" Gamache asked Gabri and Olivier. Both men shook their heads.
"He told us to go into the kitchen and stay there," said Olivier.
"He'd picked up the poker," said Gabri. "We didn't need to be told twice. I tried to call you, but of course your phone didn't work."
He held up the receiver, still clutched in his hand. Gamache turned to the agent who'd accompanied him and gestured toward Tracy.
"Watch him."
Then he led Cameron farther away from the others.
"What were you thinking?"
he demanded.
"What are you saying?"
demanded Tracy.
"I've a right to know. He was going to kill me."
"Be quiet, please,"
said Gamache, and while his tone was polite, anyone who saw the man would not be fooled by the courtesy. Even as he turned back to Cameron, Gamache admitted that what Tracy said might very well be true. It certainly looked like that. But how things looked and how they really were often two very different things in a murder investigation. He waited for an answer.
"I wanted to get a confession out of him," said Cameron. "I wanted to scare him, not beat him. I had my phone on, recording. I can show you."
"You recorded yourself threatening a suspect with a fireplace poker?" asked Gamache, incredulous. "You know that any confession you might have gotten would have been inadmissible, and the whole case thrown out."
"I would have erased the beginning," said Cameron.
Now Gamache stared, clearly dumbfounded.
"You say that as though you expect me to go along with you. I warned you about this just hours ago.
And now you do exactly the same thing?
Not the same. You warned me about hitting a suspect. I never laid a hand on him.
Threatening a beating is still brutality, said Gamache. If you were under my command, Agent Cameron, I'd relieve you of duty right now.
I'm happy to leave.
He took a step away.
You'll leave when I tell you to. What are you even doing here? This isn't your assignment.
You think my responsibility stops at the end of my shift?
Does yours? Don't question me, young man. This isn't about me. It's about your behavior.
Yeah, well, you're quite a role model, sir.
Cameron glared.
I've been following the Twitter feed about you. Have you?
I asked you a question. What are you doing here?
How can you lead, sir, if you don't have the support of the population? Wasn't that the whole point of your lecture to me? Trust? Looks like you've lost it. Have you lost it?
And the inflection made it clear that Cameron was talking about more than trust.
Answer my question now, Agent Cameron, or I'll charge you with interfering in a murder investigation.
Gamache knew exactly what Cameron was doing. He was trying to throw him off balance, put him on the defensive, get control of the narrative, and take focus away from the real question. Why was Agent Cameron there? Why was he threatening Tracy for a confession? This spoke of more than a cop going off the rails, emotionally het up about the horrific crime. It spoke, and smelled, of personal involvement.
Tell me, said Gamache. You know I'll find out.
And Cameron could see that was true. Here was a man determined to, trained to, born to find things out. Chief Inspector Gamache, sharp intent in his eyes, did not seem like the slightly pathetic, definitely incompetent, occasionally dangerous man described in the tweets.
I came because I care about Vivian, said Cameron.
And there it was, confirmation of something that had become obvious to Gamache. But Bob Cameron didn't just care. He cared so deeply he no longer had control of his actions or judgment.
I see, Gamache paused, studying the man. Were you having an affair?
No.
The truth?
No. I wanted to help her. I asked her to call me, to have a coffee together, to just talk. But she never did.
Did you go to the house?
Cameron lowered his head, no longer looking Gamache in the eye.
A few times, when I knew he wasn't there. When he was in the bar or in jail to sober up.
You detained the husband, then went up and propositioned the wife?
Cameron's face flushed, the scars turning white against the red.
It wasn't like that.
I think it was, said Gamache, and you just don't want to admit it.
She wasn't interested, but you continued to harass her.
I wasn't harassing her. She was afraid.
Cameron shot a filthy look at the man across the bistro.
She wanted to leave him. I could tell. I was just trying to help her break away.
He lifted his head and met Gamache's eyes.
I love my wife. I have two children. But there was something about Vivian. Something...
He stopped and thought.
Not innocent. Not even fragile. She seemed strong, but confused. Beaten down. I just wanted to help her.
Gamache looked at Cameron's face, disfigured, and knew how deep the blows went, how deep the disfigurement went, and knew how much this man, while a boy, would have wanted someone to help him. Motivations were rarely straightforward, as he knew all too well, and Gamache wondered how confused Cameron was between helping Vivian and helping himself. Gamache considered the man, then nodded.
Stay where you are,
he said, and walked across the bistro. He had a duty to perform, no matter how ludicrous it seemed.
Monsieur Tracy,
said Gamache, squaring himself in front of the man.
What?
I'm sorry to have to inform you.
So she is dead,
said Tracy.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Her body was found in the river just outside the village. She was thrown off that bridge.
Thrown? You make it sound like it was done on purpose.
We think it was.
Prove it.
Pardon?
How do you know she was thrown? I think she jumped, killed herself.
His voice changed.
She was very depressed, you know. It sometimes happens to pregnant women. Hormones. She talked about killing herself for weeks. I did my best. Tried to comfort her. Begged her to get help.
Tracy's voice had become wheedling, rehearsing lines for a judge.
But she wouldn't. She was drinking too much. Then she just disappeared. I was distraught.
A long, long silence greeted that. While Tracy smiled, the others in the bistro stared. Gamache tilted his head slightly. Then he nodded slightly. Tracy, with the instincts of a rodent, stopped smiling. Had he had hackles, they would have gone up, and for good reason. He'd goaded the wrong person. "Your wife was pregnant," said Gamache, his voice quiet, unnaturally calm. "The night she disappeared, she told you the child wasn't yours. You have a history of drunk and disorderly. Police have been called to your place more than once for domestic violence. Judges are smart. Juries are smart. What do you think they'll make of that?"
"I'll tell you what they'd make of it," his voice rose. "That I'm a shit husband, but not a killer. She was drunk and knocked up, and she left me. Try to prove otherwise."
"And you never asked who the father was?" demanded Gamache.
"I didn't care."
"You cared. You cared about how it looked to others. You cared about being made a fool of. We found blood in your living room and in her car. What did you do to her?" Tracy was silent. "What did you do, Carl?" The others in the room stayed absolutely still, frozen.
"I have a right to know who my wife was screwing, okay? I didn't do anything you wouldn't do, anything any normal guy wouldn't do."
He looked around, but met only disgust.
"So what did you do? Come on, Carl. Tell me."
"I gave her what for?"
"You beat her."
"My drunken, knocked-up wife? She was leaving me to go to the father. What did she think was going to happen? It was her fault."
But something besides the grotesque description struck Gamache.
"Her father or the father?" he asked.
"What did she say? Who was she going to?"
"The father, her father. What difference does it make? I took a bottle and went to my studio, passed out. When I woke up next morning, she was gone. But she was alive when I left her."
Tracy's gaze shifted to something over Gamache's shoulder. Gamache turned. Homer Godin was standing at the door, staring.
"I'm sorry, patron,"
said Agent Cloutier, coming through behind Godin. She was out of breath from running.
"I was watching the coroner, and when I turned around, he was gone."
"Don't let him close to me," said Tracy, backing away. "He's crazy."
"Homer," Gamache held his hands out in front of him, as though approaching a wounded wild animal or an explosive. It wasn't that Gamache was afraid of him, or afraid if Godin burst forward, they wouldn't be able to stop him before he killed Tracy. They could, and would. But would that really matter? Maybe if I step aside, if I was a little slow to react. Gamache knew then what he was really afraid of. Himself. How would I feel? With effort, he shoved those thoughts away, to be replaced by a certainty. They might stop him now, but they couldn't keep Homer Godin from Carl Tracy forever.
"You have your car here?"
he asked Cameron, while not taking his eyes off Godin, who wouldn't take his eyes off Tracy.
"Oui."
"Good. I'm placing him under arrest. I want you to take him in."
"Yes, sir,"
said Cameron with enthusiasm, and turned toward Tracy, who backed up further.
"No," said Chief Inspector Gamache. "Not him. Him."
Even Tracy turned to Gamache with surprise. The Chief Inspector was pointing at Homer.
"You mean Carl Tracy, sir?"
said Cameron.
"No, I mean him."
He took a step closer to Vivian's father and said,
"Homer Godin, I'm placing you under arrest."
Godin's eyes remained on Tracy, then slowly refocused on Gamache.
"What did you say?"
"I'm arresting you."
"What for?"
asked Agent Cloutier, going to stand beside Homer.
for assault.
I haven't done it yet. Give me a moment.
Gadan's voice was flat, his cold stare returning to Tracy.
And you can make it murder.
I mean the assault on Madame Gamache. You punched her in the face.
I did.
He what?
Said Gabri.
Take him in, said Gamache.
Then, in front of everyone, Gamache did something he'd never done before. He apologized, even as he made the arrest.
Désolé.
I hit your wife?
Asked Homer, more stunned by that than the arrest.
Is she all right?
She will be.
Oh, God,
sighed Homer.
What's happening?
They walked out of the bistro, Homer Godin in custody, and Carl Tracy, a free man.
Chapter 18. The morning sun was just slanting over the trees as Clara and Myrna stood on the edge of the village green and watched. Ruth joined them, limping out of her home, clutching Rosa to her chest.
What's going on?
I think they've found Vivian, said Clara, pointing to the coroner's car and then down the path along the river.
Ruth and Rosa shook their heads.
It's tragic, so young.
Then Ruth's eyes and voice sharpened.
What's he doing?
Looks like he's arresting Homer,
said Myrna, as they watched Armand walk with Homer to the Sûreté car.
He can't think, Clara began.
Jesus, even Clouseau can't be that stupid,
said Ruth.
Fuck, 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 muttered the duck.
Just then Homer stopped and turned, as did Gamache, as did everyone else on the village green.